the pod. Conversation.
The land was lush and we ruled the sea. We lived our lives so peacefully as a harmonious crew.
Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Hyle Russell.
And I'm Cameron Regal.
And Stinky Ape Summer continues as we wait out Nintendo's Direct. It'll come soon, I'm sure. Maybe they'll even announce it before this episode goes live. But in the meantime, Cameron, on this episode of The Conversation, we have lined up a very special interview. We'll be sitting down in just a few minutes with the key creators behind last month's surprise animated short, Return to Crocodile Isle, to dig into what went into the production and all of the surprise castings as well, which I think most people want to hear about. But if you haven't watched it yet, I will recap it
for
everyone.
Go now. Go. Yeah, what are you doing listening to this?
It's 9 minutes long. It's not like a lengthy time commitment, but I will recap it if you are, for example, traveling and you've already like downloaded this episode, but you can't access the YouTubes. I get it. We'll recap it for you, but I do implore you go watch it ahead of time. But before we get started, really quick, gotta plug our wares. Be sure to check us out on Patreon at dkevine.com/Patreon. You know, I'm having this pledge drive right now, Cameron, where if we can get $2,000 a month, I can devote all of my work hours and a day to DK Vine and make it the world-beating juggernaut I think we all want it to be. So if you want to support independent Donkey Kong journalism, then be sure to check us out and back us on Patreon. I also want to give a plug to our merchandise store at TeePublic. You know, Cameron, when I look at this selection of t-shirts that we have on our merchandise store, the first thing that comes to mind is, wow, what a lovely lineup of non-AI generated designs. This is obviously all done by human hands, and I think any algorithm would be able to suss that out.
Yeah, definitely made by human hands. Human anatomically accurate hands.
We put on our prosthetic golfing fingers before we design them. Look, I mean, all right, yeah. We're having a little bit of trouble right now with our profit margins because the fine folks at TeePublic, well, their bots think that we're bots. It's very confusing. But in all honesty, like, hand to log, we are actually designing them. We're not just using AI programs. The grape shirt, what machine could dream that up, I ask you. But hey, you know what? Even though our profit margins have been sliced in half, we're still getting something from them. So be sure to check us out at dkvine.com/merchandise. And you can also just search for us at TeePublic. All right, so we are about to be joined by Martin Liz, Alex Henderson, and Stuart A. Hudson of Bootleg Dub Productions and Alex Henderson Animation. But before we bring them into the studio here, Cameron, I feel like I need to recap this short in my words, right? I need to define it on the conversation's terms before we can really dig into it. And this is just wrapping my head around it as well.
I feel like this also serves the dual purpose of, we didn't do a dedicated episode about this because, I mean, we all love it, but how could we?
Yeah, the thing is, like, I knew it was coming, right? I might have had a little bit of a heads up, but there was just a lot of episodes we had to get through in the meantime, like that Merfolk episode. Bob Iger asked me to do that, Cameron. How was I going to say no? But I knew afterwards, after some time passed, I wanted to bring them in for this interview. So all those people who were, I think it was the Lego episode that set people off. How are you doing this episode about Donkey Kong Lego, and you're not talking about Return to Crocodile Isle? You're not a real Donkey Kong podcast. I'm like, I had this in the works, people. Just calm yourself down. I've got everything under control. But a lot of balls in the air, Cameron, running DK Vines, the Conversation podcast. So
yeah, that comes with the territory when you talk about K. Rool.
Yeah. So, yeah, this animated short. But again, I'm not going to do it justice. Just go watch it. But it starts on a pirate ship, which I believe is supposed to be the Gangplank Galleon. I mean, I'm not as intimately familiar with the cartoon as probably any of our listeners or you or anybody else on staff for that matter. Maybe it's Captain Scurvy's ship, but I'm going to say it's the Gangplank Galleon for my own comfort levels.
Yeah, I mean, a running theme with this animation is it blends together elements of the cartoon and game so seamlessly that I feel like it could be, one could view it as a direct follow-up to one or the other without having to think about it too hard.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're on this pirate ship, and it's docked off the coast of an island, which I think is supposed to be the remains of Crocodile Isle. Now, Crocodile Isle appears as it does in the predecessor short to this, the Curse of the Crystal Coconut video. So, for me, it looks like what Crocodile Isle might look like if it hadn't, like, completely sunk, if it just got, like, its top half blown off, and then that was it, with some, you know, artistic license in there.
Yeah, like, the crumbled remains of what was, rather than just being completely underwater.
Right, right. So, we kind of pan inside the captain's quarters, and it's been turned into a tavern. And there we see, from the off of the Donkey Kong Country cartoon, we've got General Klump and Crusha. And they're inside this tavern, and it's run by none other than Clubba from off of Donkey Kong Country 2 and Donkey Kong Land 2. So General Klump proposes a toast in memoriam of K. Rool. And in the tavern, we see numerous Kremlings from both the games and the cartoon, including Captain Scurvy, who, of course, is just modeled in the cartoon, modeled from a cannon from off of Donkey Kong Country 2, i.e. video game Klumps. So Captain Scurvy, he's got the crystal coconut, albeit the crystal coconut, it does look like the item from the games rather than the one from the cartoons. And this is also a carryover from Curse of the Crystal Coconut. We've got critters who are in their Paon era garb, as they appeared in things like King of Swing and Jungle Climber and Barrel Blast. We've got Crunches, Clingers, I believe a Kaboom in there, and a Clamp-On. And the Clamp-On is wearing a dog collar reminiscent of Crimp from off of Donkey Kong Country 3 and Land 3, or the Claptraps from off of Donkey Kong 64.
There's a really fun one I like, which is not only do we have Clubba running the bar, but we have Cudgel posted outside as like a sort of bouncer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, a lot of loving tributes from across the Donkey Kong spectrum here. And the Kremlings are all debating about what happened to K. Rool, because in this short, he has been missing for a decade. Relatable. Meanwhile, Clubba swats at a click-clack in a really nice little moment. And then deep underneath, I believe under the remains of Crocodile Isle, we see K. Rool dwelling. And this cavern seems to be like a mix of K. Rool's other hideouts.
It's got the like creepy face that his like cave hideout in the cartoon did, like in the wall of stone. Mm-hmm. But like further down, it's got the statues of the Crunches from Crocodile Core, and like, we can't possibly just rattle off every Easter egg that's in this video, or we'd be here all day.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's just more fun to discover for yourself. But a bunch of bunch of nods to his like past exploits, like the remains of Chaos are there. Some Easter eggs from contributing artists.
Yeah. So like I said, we're not going to get into every single little nugget in there. That's for you to find yourself. But Carol's sitting on his throne. I guess he's hearing the Kremlin's debate this, and he's having what seems to be trauma-induced flashbacks of his defeats from the games. We get a lot of like very quick cuts, presented as like television interference of several of his defeats across the years. And Carol shows up in the tavern, surprising everyone, and launches into a lush, sprawling, Disney-esque musical number entitled Tip the Scale. And this is a big production. I mean, it's the whole centerpiece of the short. But this musical number involves his plan to attack and raise Donkey Kong Island, burn it to the ground. It's got a four-phase plan. Phase one, storm the beaches. Phase two, burn the banana trees. Phase three, steal the hoard. Phase four, hostile takeover. I guess phase five, profit. As K-Rool belts it out, we see him dancing around the gangplank galleon. We even get a little cameo of the crow's nest from DKC2 with the eggs in there. It's a really nice little touch. So they row over to Donkey Kong Island, which appears in all of its headed glory. No Congo Bongo shape island here, my friends. This is Donkey Kong Island.
Not just a volcano either.
Right,
Full just Donkey Kong's noggin.
Yep. And anyway, they begin burning the Congo jungle. I think like flaming arrows come into it. So we see Donkey Kong's treehouse, which is modeled, the exterior at least, after the cartoon. And we see inside Donkey Kong scratching his ass in a direct homage to the Super Smash Bros. Ultimate Rivals and later Best Friends trailers, which, it burned into our brains, that image of him scratching his ass, as it should be. Donkey Kong awakens to the chaos and checks his banana hoard. And he finds it missing, Cameron. There have been peels left behind that read, "Miss me?" Which, that's a really great touch. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, that really should have been done once in the games.
I really like this sort of, because Donkey Kong is not the focal point of this music video, musical number of this, I was about to call it a music video, but I suppose it is.
It is, yeah.
He's presented with this kind of, this menacing air throughout all these scenes.
Uh-huh.
Like a force of nature.
Yeah, there's this fantastic shot of Donkey Kong here looking at his empty hoard, grimacing. And it's sort of like partially silhouetted. We've got his tie blowing in the breeze, you know, cast against the burning jungle. And he's got just like white eyes. And it looks like Batman.
It's extremely Batman the Animated Series.
Right. And it's just a great visual seeing Donkey Kong depicted in the same style as the Dark Knight, just because usually Donkey Kong doesn't have that much gravitas. And of course this is, well, I mean, this is from K. Rool's perspective, we'll say. So it's basically portraying him in a much more antagonistic, less buffoonish sort of prism. And yeah, it looked really cool. And speaking of Batman, K. Rool torches the entire banana hoard in front of Donkey Kong because, as he says, he doesn't even like bananas. Very evocative of the Joker just burning the enormous pile, mountain of cash in the Dark Knight.
I also just love this because that is genuinely canon. He says that he doesn't like bananas in Jungle Climber.
Right. Well, I mean, not to get too into the weeds right now while our guests are waiting to come in, but I think it's established that he does like bananas at one time, but given that bananas led him down the path to ruin, he has developed a distaste for them.
Being chased by a giant bird shaped like one.
Yeah, that'll do it for you. So, K. Rool then shouts to Donkey Kong, Am I Enough for You Now? Which is a very Joker-esque reframing of their relationship and the decade-long absence in the games and the drama around, you know, K-Rool not being the main villain in the retro era games or Jungle Beat. And I thought that was really clever. I was like, ah.
It is my, like, I think my single favorite moment in the whole animation where, like, the line delivery, the script, and just the animation all comes together for this super strong moment, compounded with, but well, punctuated with K-Rool's eye twitching.
Yeah, yeah. They tone down the eye tick like throughout most of this, like it isn't really present, but they do make use of it for dramatic effect when needed. So yeah, they have K-Rool break out the blunderbuss right here, which is always great to see. Love that blunderbuss. And he shoots Donkey Kong. And only to reveal that he shot the Donkey Kong dummy in his lair, like blew a hole through its chest, and that this whole montage was nothing more than K-Rool's fantasy as like, I think the, like the tavern burns around him.
At the very least, the basement he was hiding in.
Yeah.
In ashes.
Yeah, yeah. It the whole thing was just K-Rool's mad delusion. And then we cut to the credits. But this is a production about King K-Rool, so this is obviously going to involve a fake-out with the credits. So there is more to the story. So I'm not delving into all of the Easter eggs and lovely touches or this kind of like epilogue to it, as I would implore everyone who hasn't done so to watch it on YouTube. However, the biggest omission I have left out up until this point is the voice cast, which is the big, big, I think, drawing point. I mean, this whole production is lovely, but I don't think it would have had the same impact had they not gotten the cast from the Donkey Kong Country cartoon. So you actually got K-Rool's voice actor from the show, Benedict Campbell, back for this sprawling animated short. They also got Adrian Tuss back as General Klump, Ron Rubin as Captain Scurvy, and in the big surprise in the after credits reveal, Richard Yearwood appears as Donkey Kong, the voice of Donkey Kong from the cartoon, speaking voice at least. So yeah, that was Return to Crocodile Isle. All right, please welcome the crew of Return to Crocodile Isle. With us is Martin Liz, director.
How are you doing, everyone?
We got Alex Henderson, assistant director, storyboard, and animation.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And Stuart A. Hudson, creative consultant and numerous voices.
How's it going? Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. So, we got some questions to ask you, as did some of our followers and listeners. We opened the field, and most of them all asked the same thing. We did get some different questions, so we'll be mixing them in throughout this episode. Cameron, would you like to start things off?
Question for all three of you, Alex, Stuart, and Martin. Can you give our listeners a bit of context as to who you are and what you do outside of brilliant musical Donkey Kong videos?
Brilliant. Man, we're starting off strong here. My name is Martin Liss. I'm the founder and, the guy running Bootleg Dub Productions, something I kind of started during the midst of the pandemic. Before all this, I was kind of big on, like, doing voiceover, helping friends with, like, a bridge series and dubs and different things like that. Eventually kind of retired out of, like, the voice acting thing and wanted to, like, focus a little bit more behind the scenes. And, since the start of the pandemic, I think my first official project really was F-Zero Overdrive, which was probably the most expensive fan dub ever made of one of the episodes of F-Zero, kind of catered to more of a American Toonami kind of styled audience, where I just redid all the sound design. And outside of that, we just kind of decided to work on to original animation from here with Curse of the Crystal Coconut and Return to Crocodile Isle. And yeah, outside of that, I'm just kind of working promo products on the side and do some random background acting work here and Toronto to help pay for the bills a little bit more. So if you randomly see me as like some like guy number five on like Suits or The Boys or something like that, that's me.
And I'm Alex Henderson. I did all the animation for the project and helped with directing the story. And not only like animating for this, animation is my full-time job. I've been doing it professionally for the last 10 years or so. I've worked for a couple of studios. I've worked on TV shows, short films, advertising, video games. And about 5 years ago, I left studio work to pursue a freelance career. And I've been sort of developing my own independent projects, working on other people's independent projects. And for the last few months, Return to Crocodile Isle has been one of those big projects.
Y'all are going in so hard, it's going to make me feel so inadequate by comparison. So, hi, I'm Stuart. I am the voice director and voice caster, and I guess that's the casting director. I voice Prussia, Kaboom, Swanky, and then I'm the intro voice from the narration portion of the song. I've been in voice acting, doing voice acting stuff since I was probably about 15. I've been obsessed with it. I've worked with Terminal Montage on several things. I'm trying to think if there's anything exciting about me. I do pest control for a living, so that's a thing. But yeah, I'm really not as exciting as the other two. But I guess I could say that, you know, this whole DK universe, DKC universe, has been kind of like a thing that I wanted to do since early childhood, since playing the original games. I always felt that there could be like, you know, a story there. So I kind of wanted to, you know, we got Martin together and then we got Alex and we just kind of pulled our brains together and came up with this thing. So
yeah, Stuart and me known each other since like 2010. We were kind of like getting ourselves involved in like different voiceover projects. And I'll tell you as much as over here. And I think the short speaks for itself. Stuart just has like an impeccable range with all the different characters and voicing that he does. Like, voice acting is like in his core and heart, like in soul and everything he does. So,
thank you.
see what I mean? I can barely tell that's Charlie Adler or not. But no, in all seriousness, it's just I know this was like something Stuart wanted to work as a big passion project for the longest time. And after we were kind of wrapped up with the F-Zero thing, I felt it was just best to kind of take the initiative and you know, kind of finance, produce, work with around writing. And Stuart's just always been huge on like the lore and the kind of writing, but behind a lot of like Donkey Kong Country things. And I mean, the best way we could really put it is just that kind of Jackson and Doc combination from Venture Bros. Is just like, we just kind of butted our heads into this and, you know, essentially just made it up out of pure oil grease and hard labor, what we kind of made.
Well, you also had some collaborators that listeners of the conversation may be familiar with, including Uncle Al on writing. He was one of our guest well-wishers on our 40 Years of Donkey Kong episode, if you're not familiar with his channel. And then Chris Adelorado, better known as Grunt in the community, contributing background on art, among many others. So how did you decide who to bring in on this project? And from those who provided creative contributions, or even those you used as a test audience, which I believe included the likes of Chris Sutherland, who, of course, famously worked on Donkey Kong Country 1 and 2.
Yeah, so the thing is, like, when I was, you know, working around with how I wanted to go about this, my big thing has always just been to make this, like, a collaboration thing. And very often, I just kind of work with either people that I've, you know, known for a good while, or those whose work I've like greatly admired. And a lot of these people are like, I've kind of spoken to like in the past or in like good detail about like their work ethic and whatnot. In regards to the creative side, I honestly, it just kind of goes into like a lot of different reasons. We know that from a writing standpoint, we wanted to add like some like good, you know, backbone and humor to like what we wanted to kind of design around it. And Al was, you know, on board with helping us through it. I always just loved his, you know, videos, his comedy style and everything in between with that. And he was originally supposed to be a DK before, you know, we got other opportunities kind of opening up from the union side of things, which we'll get into a little bit later. But yeah, it's just like such a wonderful community that we work with. Just like a lot of people just have a passion for like Donkey Kong and know what we're looking for. And I always purposely try and find something that's a little bit more fun for like their style. And it's like fantastic. Like in the case of Grunt specifically, we knew he specialized in puppets, and we were kind of thinking, what if we just kind of we couldn't exactly like have it like as a character there because it like stick out a little bit. But we were thinking, what if we kind of did like one of those fancy oil paintings, but kind of seconded it almost like as one of those haunted portraits. Like in one part of the scene, you see it as Mr. X, and in the other side the version, it was like, you know, the cackle, the official version that was in Donkey Kong Country 2. And it was just like full of like fun little Easter eggs and just working with each and every one of them. And the details were always just so, you know, amazing to just kind of put a little bit more color and lore into our world. And this was something me and Stuart really discussed in great detail, the kind of people we wanted to work with on this. And Stuart obviously, you know, had the check-in and wanted to make it something where it would like really build the kind of color that he wanted to build with the lore of this. And I think from an artistic standpoint, it was just fantastic. If you want to add anything in particular, Stu.
Oh, I mean, you're pretty much hitting every, you know, nail on the head. The only thing that I would say is that I'm the ideas guy. Martin's just the guy who keeps me in check.
Yeah. And, you know, for the test audience part is actually another fun little fact I figured might as well kind of throw in on top of a lot of the amazing creative contributions. We actually got like some original Nintendo employees involved in the project, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you might notice that our logo, Return to Crocodile Isle, was actually specifically graphic designed by Jim Wornell, who you might actually recognize as the guy who did all the Nintendo's title graphics from like the 90s to like 2000s, like Ocarina of Time, Animal Crossing, Metroid Prime, which that one took apparently like 80 different revisions apparently from his stories. But yeah, I think it's as close as an official Nintendo production could ever get. It's just we worked with like both like, you know, people that just kind of do it for fun or amateur, and, you know, those that actually worked in the industry. We worked with different kinds of genres of artists and those with like different unique capabilities and styles. And I just, like, part of me just really loves giving like this kind of variety and difference with the kind of world building that we want to make over here. Regarding the test audiences, this was an interesting discussion that, you know, me, Stuart, and Alex also went very deeply into. When we went into making this video, we wanted to make sure, and I think this goes into rule for any kind of project, whether it be fan-based or not, you want to make a good quality film first and a fan, you know, content matter second. So we worked with many different test audiences to kind of group with this. We had, you know, obviously the big Donkey Kong fans like Yu Heil and Kremlin Campaigner and Grunt just like on one end over here. On the other end, we actually had people from the, you know, gaming industry like that actually were involved and know about Donkey Kong. People like Chris Sutherland and Daily Kong. And for the animation portion, this was something that was like a little bit more central with Alex, actually. And I know we actually got like some, you know, professional animation folk or animation critics like Saber Spark was also involved with, you know, giving us some input. And I think it was it Joaquin Baldwin that also helped with critiquing this too, Alex?
Yeah. Joaquin and several other of like my animation industry buddies. We had them look over it too, just because I felt like we need people who aren't necessarily Donkey Kong fans, but maybe have more general filmmaking experience to kind of provide their own insights to this.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt like a lot of this just kind of intertwined into like how we wanted to shape this just right, which I think was just like amazing on like all ends, where it's just like, even if you're not a Donkey Kong fan, you could still appreciate like the animation or the music. If you're like a fan of the character and like all the other stuff that in between, you're actually able to like appreciate all the little stuff more and more, which, you know, our goal was to make sure people feel like they need to watch it 15 or 20 times in order to just catch everything. And yeah, I think we did a good job given the amount of comments we've had, people like playing it every single day and singing along in the comments.
Yeah, only 15 or 20 times.
Only, yeah, I'm surprised too.
So we have to ask this. We want to know, and Our audience certainly does, since this was the question most posited when we solicited them for this episode. Benedict Campbell, Adrian Truss, Ron Rubin, Richard Yearwood. How? What? How? What? That is to say, how did you recruit all these big gets, and what was it like working with them stepping back into their old roles?
Oh, this is like an entire adventure of its
own.
You know, the thing is, like, even before we did this whole Donkey Kong thing, you know, Stuart and I, like, we really enjoyed the old animated series. Like, say what you will about, you know, the graphics at the time. It was, you know, peak for its age. Things age interestingly. But one thing we just always appreciate, especially, like, from people that, like, enjoy, that are big on, like, sound and voiceover and stuff like that, they just always knew how to, like, have fun with the sound stuff. The songs could be a little bit, you know, cheesy, but they were kind of catchy, and you could tell people were having fun, and everyone in the voice cast was just so perfectly in sync together, and this is exactly how I, like, imagine, like, the characters talking. It's like, even when I was, like, watching the Mario Brothers movie, it's like, I was honestly still thinking Aaron Tager would have been, like, a more lively voice. Like, yeah, it's like, that's the kind of, like, it's just like, this kind of stuff is just ingrained into how I imagine the characters. I know you have your own thoughts about the writing, Kyle, but being said, I still feel like the voices really captured the kind of characters I wanted to, like, to be in this. And this was something me and Stuart greatly respected about them. So when we went into this project, one thing that I always wanted to have, like, for Bootleg Dubs production stuff was, you know, if we're going to go into this, we want to make it seem as, like, you know, high caliber as we could, and just bring something exciting back. We want to have something that people don't feel that they want, but something that they didn't realize they needed, quote unquote. And one of the big things we obviously talked about was, like, you know, just getting Ben to do something for this. And we joked about having him involved in, like, you know, when we were, like, when Stuart was, like, still working on, like, you know, doing, like, some dubs and characters, like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if we got Benedict Campbell over here? And, you know, it's like, you know, actors' offices are just, like, you know, it's, like, only an hour away. I'm, like, I live in Toronto, so it's, like, I could just walk in there, maybe ask him. We just constantly joke about that for, like, years and years. And then this point kind of hit, and it's just, like, you know, maybe we should actually see if these guys would be willing. Well, at the time, it was just we were aiming for Ben. We didn't have, like, an idea what kind of thing we wanted to do. We were originally trying to make this into a... This started off as a simple parody track of, like, Hamilton's You'll Be Back. And eventually, like, when we kind of just started digging deeper and deeper into this, we eventually made into, like, the original song that it is. But we decided to just kind of figure out where Ben was exactly. And we had, like, no luck trying to find him at the time. And it wasn't until one day me and Stuart ended up watching, you know, a clip from the movie Ice Princess Lily from 2019. And this was like from a German film, like Tabaluga, and it was, like, being done into an English dub over here. But obviously with the whole Frozen craze that was happening, it was clearly they were trying to cap off of, like, the Frozen market. So they changed it from Tabaluga and made it about a side character, Ice Princess Lily. And in that, Benedict actually voiced an evil snowman named Arctos. And there's a moment he has the villain song in there, and we just kind of witnessed it. It's just like, there is no way. He still got it. He's aged like fine wine. There's no reason a villain song should be going this hard from him. And we was just like, okay, we definitely know he still got it. He's still alive. He's still out there somewhere. And was it you that found, like, a really, really obscure Twitter account that managed to contact Ben, was it? Yeah.
I was like doing some sleuthing on Twitter, and I was like, I came across what I thought was Ben's Twitter, and so I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I think I sent you the link, and you said to me, hey, you know, we could at least try reaching out to him. And I was like, I don't know if he'll respond.
Yeah, his posts were like 2 years old.
Yeah. You're like, well, it's worth a shot. And I was like, okay, let's do it. And so I went and sent him a message, and I said, hey, you know, this is Stuart. I'm a big fan of your work. I was just curious if there was any means, you know, that we could get in contact with you. And probably about 2 months went by, and then finally I had an alert in my inbox, and I checked it, and sure enough, it was Ben. And he was like, here's my agent. Contact my agent.
And it just got kind of nuttier from there because, I mean, we had like a lot of ideas for like casting and voices, but like once we actually started getting, you know, in working with Ben on this stuff, we had to speak with the acting union that was responsible for like a lot of the voice stuff because, you know, Ben and all the other guys are all involved in it. So it was a matter of me having to discuss with all the representatives, the folks and agents that kind of went through this. And that was like a good 8 months of just trying to negotiate and stuff like that. And these actor was just fantastic to kind of work with. It was a lot of paperwork and time and just things to kind of go through. But they've been very patient, accommodating for what we were going through. It was just like a simple fan production. And yeah, it was from there. We kind of had to work around the script quite a few times because there was like a lot of different like guidelines we had to change around, whether it be taking off like a certain amount of characters because, you know, we had to have specifically more number of, you know, voice actors from actor involved than like people outside of it. I had to work around getting permits and studying the laws of, you know, each state for like the other voice actors we wanted to get involved in. And that kind of caused like a bunch of our ideas to kind of, you know, wither away and kind of work out and like work in its own regard. But I think at the end with what we managed to like, you know, limit ourselves to with the resources and kind of work through with a lot of the powerhouses of stuff, it just really turned out for the better. And from there, we got to like, you know, work around with Adrian, Ron and Richard when we kind of got in contact with them. They all have their great stories. Adrian is... Adrian was, you know, hilarious to work with. He's like, his dry sense of humor is, you know, just a staple of the guy. And Klump was actually his first voice role he ever did. So it was actually like a good personal thing for him to like get back into doing this. In the case of Ron, we weren't even sure if we were going to be getting him. So at the time, we were kind of thinking, we kind of originally had a Claptrap where we were thinking maybe he could reprise him, but, you know, if not, we're just going to work around and have his older brother be Clamp on and voiced by our friend JP, who's, you know, also a fantastic voice actor and really knocked it out. And when we got to working with Ron, there was a little bit of a pause as to, like, what we were kind of working on just because he had to go through, like, some procedures that were kind of personal. But we ended up kind of waiting for him and kind of were showing him about, like, the character and like, scurvy and everything. Because we wanted to at least have him for scurvy. And I kid you not, he honestly didn't remember voicing the character. I'm not even kidding. It's like...
5 years.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah. Like, he's been in... if you think about it, he's been in 3 episodes, yes. But it's, like, very catchy... He has the best songs. He has like some of the best scenes in my opinion.
Right.
It's kind of funny. I was just like, you know, it says on your IMDb, you're behind the voice act. He's like, I don't remember voicing him. Are you sure it was someone else? Like, and you know, eventually like he did remember by the time we had our screening in Toronto. And that was like really hilarious, but it was honestly kind of funny because, you know, Ron was a voice actor that I've grown up with like a lot of like early Canadian television on my end. It was Morphin X-Men, the animated series that was like a show that is very near and dear to my heart. He was Artemis in like the first stuff for Sailor Moon, my introduction to like Japanese animation. He was like in a bunch of other stuff like Sticking Around and the Beetlejuice animated series and, you know.
Jerry from Totally Spies.
Oh, no, that was Adrian. That was Adrian.
Oh, that was Adrian. My bad.
That was Adrian, yeah. Which was still kind of funny to think. But yeah, Ron was great to just kind of chat with and, you know, getting to work with him and kind of telling him about like some of the recording stories that he had were great. Richard, he was a very special case actually, because he's one of the only ones in the union that I think works both in the US and Canada. And he's kind of going back and forth in between. And we've been trying to find this guy's number for like a good while or some way to contact him. So when we were negotiating our contracts with, our lead rep during a call and just going over everything. And I just kind of mentioned, I've been trying to get a hold of Richard, but I have no idea where I'm supposed to look. And then a rep was just like, hang on. And she just texted him. And she's like, Rich, they want you for a Donkey Kong thing. Would you be interested? And he's like, yeah, I'd love to. Cool. And then he's like, okay, back to business.
That Donkey Kong thing.
Yeah.
Was it Ron who thought that this was an official production?
He initially did. He actually asked, how did you guys get the rights? He's like, oh no, we're doing this as a fan thing. He's just like, so where'd you get all the money? He's like, I'm financing this all by myself. And he's just like, Lord have mercy.
The overhead.
Yeah. And, man, just the recording sessions were really fun. But, I think that's probably a bit of a later question down the line, but it was just, those guys are just like fantastic to like work with overall, and you know, just getting to interact with them and all that crazy stuff. It's been, we didn't even think we went that far. We just did the simple thing is like, just try and ask, and it got us this far, and through a lot of trials and tribulations, it just kind of ended up where we are now, which, you know, I don't recommend anyone to like, you know, go out of their way to, you know, work with the union, unless it's like a huge project that you're absolutely feel like it's going to work out and everything. But in the case of this, it's just such a beautiful way this kind of just worked out in the end. And
it's a perfect storm.
And it was a perfect storm, exactly.
So it's impressive enough to have recruited so many of the cartoon's original voice talent for an original animation, but I think it's on a whole nother level to have Ben Campbell sing lead on an original song with original lyrics backed by multiple musicians. What was the composing, writing, directing process like for that with so many moving parts?
Josh was kind of the, I mean, we all kind of contributed in terms of writing and like pushing the story in a certain direction, but Josh, our composer, was kind of,
he carried
definitely
it.
Carried us for the whole thing in absolutely. Terms of music.
Yeah, when me and Stuart were originally starting out, we obviously were doing the Hamilton thing, and then as we were getting further into this, it was Alex that suggested, well, why don't you guys just make an original song since we're going this big? And me and Stuart just looked at each other being like, we don't even know how to write music. So what kind of first started off was just Stuart made like an entire track that was essentially like a whole leitmotifs of a lot of the different like Donkey Kong, you know, Kremlin inspired music, like the what was the sea shanty called again?
It was a Jib Jig. We got Crook's March. Gosh, there was a few other ones too that I threw in there.
No, it was like I know they had like the Wellerman thing, like also referenced.
Yeah.
It was just like a whole bunch of different hodgepodge of things, and we just kind of decided, hey, we'll try and maybe write some lyrics around this. And I remember like I kind of just pitched like a whole slew of things that a lot of it just ended up in the final script, and I was like really impressed. But it's just like singing wise and like note wise is just like something wasn't exactly working out, and we were trying to figure out like the right composer for the job and seeing what works. And Alex, with his history with Josh from The Rhino and the Red Bill, we kind of worked with him and showed him this. And initially he thought this was original music, and then we explained to him, no, this is just a bunch of old themes just kind of clashed together, and he had to kind of write the, you know, instruments and music and all that stuff based on it instead. But he literally took like what is like hieroglyphics that we've made
and transcribed just, it
and managed to like transcribe it to like, you know, all these amazing different like genres. It's like obviously there was like a lot of like Disney villain inspired kind of things to it, but somehow it also just ended up also being like it almost felt like a Broadway musical and like a whole entire rap segment that, you know, didn't feel like it was trying to be modernizing and cringy somehow. I don't know how we did it. It's just we kind of had like so many ideas. We were focusing on so many of the different singing styles like K. Rool had. It's for the rap part specifically, I remember we were looking over like, you know, the Diddy drop rap. He was like, okay, this guy can rap. We want to give him something. Yep. Want to give him something strong with this.
Rap in quotation marks.
Yeah. We can give him
no
something.
No pity for Diddy.
And it's like, seriously, it's like there was like so many different kind of styles and genres we just kind of looped into this. The DK rap thing was like a really cool, like intimidating way to start off. We had the harpsichord thing, and then we had like hints of like Grant Kirkhope's kind of musical style, and then we had like some of what was the track Mining Melancholy from David Wise. We had like, yes, some of the sound effects kind of also like during that bit of part of the rap as well. It's just like so many different like colors and styles that just clashed it together. I think I think Josh was just like the cornerstone of this all. He just really knew how to work this, and I don't feel it could have been the same without him. Even when he was like directing the voice actors with the singing bits as to how it was, how parts were to be sung, I don't think we would have gotten this far without someone as fantastic as him. And you know, it's like when I said, like, you know, Josh just kind of immediately knew the kind of tone we were setting with the lyrics we were going. And even though there was like some back and forth over trying to figure out how things would go, Josh would always find like new amazing creative ways how to like go about the track. And admittedly, it ended up being longer than we initially anticipated, because we were kind of going with the rule of how long should a song should be. Well, a lot of the Disney ones are like 3 minutes long, and this ended up being 5 minutes. And, you know, it just kind of like ended up being like a beast of its own. It's just like, man, this isn't just like a standard musical number anymore. It's like, I don't even know what kind of genre
this is. Advanced Disney.
This is like all over the place. Like, and I remember, yeah, Josh mentioned specifically the rap section was like the most fun to part to write and arrange. And man, when recording with Ben, that was like one of the best parts too, actually.
Yeah, Ben loved that part.
Yeah. And I remember it was like a 2-hour session of like in the recording studio with him. And, you know, I think the biggest highlight was just him mentioning, this is probably better than most of the songs that were actually on the show. And it's just like, I mean, maybe it's not like a, you know, high compliment to you, Heil, but, you know.
No, I would agree with that. It's definitely better than anything. No.
But yeah, it just meant a lot because, you know, we just studied like all the songs and singing styles and different, you know, composers that were involved in Donkey Kong with like David Wise and Grant Kirkhope and all that other stuff. And like Disney villain musical numbers, like, you know, Be Prepared was a big one. You know, the bar setting was like really inspired by like Radigan's and like Gaston's like music, like bits. I think there was hints of Friends from the Other Side from The Princess Frog, Savages from Pocahontas. There was obviously like a lot of Governor Ratcliffe kind of inspiration for like K Roulette bits here and there. It was like a hodgepodge of things. It's just like we wanted this to just be like a tribute of these kind of things, but we're just kind of surprised of the life it just kind of took on its own and what Josh was able to do with it. It was just fucking magnificent.
So before we move on from the cast and everything, I think it's worth pointing out that you were able to bring back the original voice cast from the cartoon. Of course, with the obvious exception of Len Carlson, who voiced Crusha and sadly passed away in 2006. So, Stuart, you actually were the one who filled in for Crusha. What was it like stepping into those shoes?
Oh, man, it was a process. So, I'm not gonna, like, play it up at all, but through the first, like, 2 months of just scripting and getting the idea of how much we wanted to include Crusha in the script, I was literally going through all of his, like, catalog, Len Carlson's catalog of just stuff that he had voiced in prior. And just kind of familiarizing myself with the role just so I could really hone in and figure out what his range was.
Just to keep in mind, his voice, like his entire repertoire is like pretty big. He's been like around since like 60s Spider-Man cartoon. Like,
yeah.
Voiceover.
Yeah. Some of the stuff I was like looking back on, I was like, wow, he was in that, you know, like, I think, he was the voice of, Bert Raccoon from The Raccoons, if you're familiar with that show. He's done a lot of stuff. But yeah, I basically went back and I rewatched a lot of the stuff that he was in and just kind of really acquainted myself with his voice stylings and, that kind of just went from there.
I just want to say you did a fucking amazing job with, Crush Over.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's always like a difficult decision because
couldn't agree
like,
more.
I feel like a lot of this was a, like an active tribute where, all the characters that have been portrayed in media before, we don't want to change their voices. We want to have them like the same as they were. And anyone that was a newcomer is based on characters that have never been adapted on screen before. So, you know, Clubba and like Clubba was done by Tom fantastically. That was inspired by, you know, Pirates of Dark Waters role of Mantis. Yeah. It was like a Peter Cullen's, like one of his first roles too. And, yeah, it's like for Kaboom, which you also did, Stuart. It was
actually, to preface that, like I had gone through and basically taken every character and just set them with a voice preset of like who or like a template, voice template of like who in a, you know, in a perfect world, this character should be voiced by. And we kind of use that as a roadmap for casting. And it really, really helped. But yeah, Kaboom was Charlie Adler.
And so whenever I did his voice, I got really high up in here because he sounds kind of nasally. He's kind of scatterbrained and, you know.
Interesting story with that. I remember we were before we got into the whole actor bind, we were trying to figure out voice actors that would go for him. And we I think we actually did try reaching out to Charlie Adler at some point, and he didn't get back to us. And then we were thinking, you know, just with how great his screams are, maybe we should just get Zach Hadle and see if he would have fun with it. Didn't get a response on that either. And I know we were also, me and Stuart were big Transformers Beast Wars fans and loved Inferno. So we were thinking, maybe we could get Jim Burns for it. And, you know, it was within that time we were kind of understanding it was limiting itself with, like, the actor contracts and who we were going to work. So we had to, like, focus around multicasting. And Stuart is just like he's a damn chameleon, like a lot of the roles and voices that he does. It's like the man could do like almost any kind of voice I envision. It's just like, And so ironically, we kind of turned that around. It's like, you know what? Just do Charlie Adler voice. It's like, we'll do it the way we kind of initially wanted to start it. And yeah, it was that. And the swanky cameo I know was, Darren Norris, I believe. Like, knockout voice from Transformers Prime, or?
Yes, indeed. With a little bit of, oh gosh, now I can't remember his name. But there's another actor that I blended with him and kind of came up and arrived at Swanky Kong. Who's the guy who voices? This is such a stupid question, but who's the guy who voices Richard Impossible? Steve Colbert.
Stephen Colbert.
Yeah. So he's like a hodgepodge of Stephen Colbert and Darren Norris.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And trying to remember, because I also know that you're doing the part with the I know, like, when you were doing, like, you know, the announcer bit, you based that off of, like, the Killer Instinct voice from the announcer, was it not?
Yeah.
That was also there too. But yeah, Stuart is just like he's like a damn chameleon with this stuff. He knows his reptiles, he knows how to act like one, and he managed to just like work with so many different like voices and just give off this kind of variety. It's just, he's as excellent a voice actor as he's a director.
Aw.
So, as we've kind of mentioned a bit earlier, this isn't this crew's first dance with Donkey Kong, as all of you previously worked together on the DKC Curse of the Crystal Coconut animated short, which was set to Aelstorm's cover of Pirate Scorn, and which this animation served as sort of a sequel. How did that project come about, and how did your experience with it inform the second go-around with this cast of characters?
Oh my fucking god, the story behind this.
I mean,
Alex
originally,
and Stuart know this well, too well.
Yeah, well, so originally Return to Crocodile Isle, that was the one that was first in production. That was what these guys first reached out to me about. But as we mentioned before, like the whole dealing with getting the voice actors on and dealing with ACTRA.
And writing the music.
Yeah, that took a lot longer than we expected. And since, because getting all that together meant we couldn't start animating, there wasn't really much for me to do, so what I kind of came up with was the idea that since you guys have kind of introduced me to that cover of the song.
Yeah.
And but since I still wanted a video up for my channel, I still wanted to like work on something like this. Cause like, this was right in the middle of the pandemic. We were still under quarantine. So I was kind of looking for fun side projects just to kind of, you know, explore creatively. And I came up with the idea of doing a music video for that song, since it's a pretty short song, and working on that would allow us to kind of develop the assets for this project. So I pitched the idea to you guys and we just kind of moved forward with it. I storyboarded it, I animated it, composited it, released it, and it was a big hit for my channel.
I mean, honestly, it was like just a great learning experience overall, because for the longest time, me and Stuart just kind of worked around with, like, you know, sound and like voiceover and things like that. We didn't know how things really worked on like a visual aspect, and I want to say, like, my experience with working with F-Zero Project was, like, really had me appreciate and understand the other parts outside of voiceover. Like, original music and sound effects and stuff like that, and how it like all kind of comes together. With Curse of the Crystal Coconut, all the audio was already done. It was a matter of how to focus on it visually. So a lot of times it was Alex showing us how things were going, the kind of steps, and really my role in the job was just kind of giving my thumbs up. I was like, yeah, this looks good. Keep doing this. Looks amazing. And Alex was just showing us like all the crazy steps that he does, from like storyboarding to like, you know, making the models and how things are like positioned, the background art like being made, and like putting everything into motion, and the lighting is just like, it's like watching a Bob Ross painting. It's like every moment is just like, I feel a little bit better about my life. It's the amount of peace and beauty I'm seeing before me being made into like such a, just a pristine like fucking image right in front of me, into what it was made. And honestly, it's just like us communicating with Alex actually got us like a lot more closer to understanding how we wanted to work around with the project. And I honestly do feel it was for the better, because whereas like my past experience in F-Zero was like with sound, and working with Alex on this was like a visual thing that we got to work around with, like a lot of the Easter eggs and the little fun stuff. I think that the experience of both of these helped accumulate how to best go about with Return to Crocodile Isle, because we were developing original audio and original visuals with everything. And honestly, I don't think it would be like in the same kind of quality without it. And lo and behold, after we got around with Alex finishing this, we were still trying to figure out how to work around with, you know, getting the other stuff going. Alex, I know you you reached out to Napalm Records, the guys that you know have Alestorm as their band.
Yeah, that's their record label. Yeah.
Yeah, their record label, and you asked them permission to use the song. They didn't tell the band. They didn't tell the band about any of this.
I emailed the band. It might have got sent to their spam folder because I never heard back. But I did email the record label, and they said, "Yeah, yeah, that's cool. Go for it."
And then the band reaches out to Alex a few days later. I think was it.
It was a few days. It was about a couple weeks after we uploaded the song. Yeah, they reached out.
A couple weeks.
Since making the video, I've gone on to develop a working relationship with the band and the record label. Like, I've done a couple of music videos for Alestorm and Gloryhammer. So yeah, like since that video, we just had this really great working relationship. Like, I'm still working on projects for them now. So
still find it hilarious. Where it's like, yeah, we saw this fan project you did of ours with Donkey Kong. Do you think we could hire you for an official video? Yeah, and it's like, we were just like, Alex, take the opportunity. Me and Stuart just hold the fort, trying to figure this shit out a little bit more. You have fun.
It'll buy us more time.
Yeah, yeah. So, Alex, it was a really interesting thing because, you know, Alex hopped on Curse of the Crystal Coconut, then worked on onto a PARTY, which I think the biggest, like, thing that, I think the biggest compliment ever was just seeing that our Curse of the Crystal Coconut thing was canon, I guess, in the Alestorm universe with the... the fact that you see clumps and scurvy skulls next to the crystal coconut. But yeah, then Alex went back and animated the main part of the thing that we managed to complete. And then he jumped back to with Napalm to help with the Gloryhammer video, Keeper of Celestial Flame, which is, oh my goodness, so many new techniques I didn't know you could actually do, man. And then
yeah,
after,
it's definitely probably, not in terms of scale, but in terms of like the kind of animation I did, it's probably one of the more ambitious ones I've done.
Absolutely.
Pretty mind-blowing.
And then you came back, and then we worked on the post-credit scene, and then released it in time for May. And I think at this point, Alex just wants a good long break from fucking pirates.
I'd be up for more pirates, you know, you never know.
I have to say, releasing Curse of the Crystal Coconut first, you know, because I was tagged about it fairly quickly after it was uploaded. It was probably only a matter of minutes before somebody tagged DK Vine on social media and I was kind of alerted to its existence. And of course, you know, like, we'll get into my personal childhood opinions of the cartoon in a little bit, I'm sure, but I'm naturally going to be skeptical of anything. It's like, oh, this is based on the cartoon. My shields are up, my guard is up. And I watched it and I was like, well, this is really well done. But the part that completely melted my frozen, cynical, dead heart was when you showed Funky Kong just lounging in his like beach cabana, and he raises his sunglasses and he's just got the most bloodshot eyes. And I'm like, oh, They nailed it.
He was seeing green clouds in the cartoon. Yes. So I was like, you know what? Yeah, might as well green clouds.
Yeah. So that got me on board, and that's why I was just naturally inclined to appreciate the second video, the 9-minute Return to Crocodile Isle, without any prejudices that might be clouding my judgment.
I mean, yeah. I think we all knew the show's kind of reputation going into this, and we had a bit of a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, we know it's like a lot of memes kind of based around this, but I do feel like there was genuine effort, and I think what makes our we specifically call it DKC just as like our own little universe thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I feel like it's what makes this really special is we kind of just combined a lot of the best elements that we appreciate from like the games and the animated series and everything into just like our own little canon, like, so to say. It's just like, you feel this would feel believable if you like placed it at some point in like Return to Crocodile. It was clearly the middle ground between K. Rool's last game appearance, or Donkey Kong 64, however you want to put it, and the Smash Bros. Reveal. So it's like, I wanted to give something of like that felt genuine, that people would appreciate, would like respect like the best parts of all the universes and things that made K. Rool and like so many of the other characters like who they are. But you know, people don't feel like it's like us excluding something because we're making fun of it. We're just literally seeing the strengths of everything that's been kind of adapted before, and just kind of making this like I guess like a perfect jigsaw puzzle out of everything we've made.
I was actually gonna bring up. So I was part of one of the test audiences like months and months before it premiered.
Yeah, and you know why we got you.
Yeah. So just personally revealing this, when I was brought in, like I had no idea what this was about. And, you know, I showed up and I was like, oh. Grunt was there, and I was like, oh, hi, Grunt. What are you doing here? And so I was specifically told that I was there because I was someone in the community who infamously didn't like the cartoon, and you wanted to gauge my reaction. I was like the part of the experiment, you know, to like gauge the, I don't know, acidity or whatever. So like I was like
barometer.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, sure. And you know, like let me just clarify like here and now like my feelings on the cartoon. So yes, growing up I did not appreciate the Donkey Kong Country cartoon being such a games purist. I'm too close to the source material. I love it too much. And it's something I had to mature out of and accept. And the Super Mario Brothers movie was a great test of that, where I could walk into something that isn't 100% faithful, but I can still appreciate it on its own merits. It was a learning experience for me. But, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you don't really have that insight. But as time went on, especially during the Smash Ballot, I really did grow to appreciate the effect that the cartoon had on so many people and bringing so many people into the fandom as either the thing that first introduced them to Donkey Kong, or even just the memes and everything later on that kind of introduced
them. Canadian tax dollars. Literally, Canada's government funded this thing to be made as part of their animation program for children's viewing. So literally, they were funded by Canadian tax dollars.
It's better than any of the stuff that Cameron and my tax dollars go to, I'm sure. But I really do believe, I said this, I think, at our MAGFest panel, Cameron, I really think that if it wasn't for the cartoon, K. Rool probably wouldn't have gotten into Smash, because he had, like, that portrayal had such an impact on people and then impacted the Smash Ballot. So I do not hate the cartoon. I can begrudgingly love it from afar. But what I really loved about both of these productions was that process of blending the cartoon characters and kind of the vibe and some of the humor into this aesthetic that more closely matches the classic video games from Rare, specifically Donkey Kong Country 2. And I just have to give like everybody involved a big round of applause, because you were able to win over the most stalwart opposition you might have in me. So thank you.
We knew it the moment Clubba came on board and K-Rool mentioned Kremlin. He said the word. He finally says Kremlin.
Yeah, they were. What was it? Lizards or reptiles?
Yeah, they always referred to them
as lizards. Yeah, yeah.
Critters, yeah. Like anything but Kremlin, they would say.
Right.
I wonder if that might have been like because like the whole Russia thing, but I don't know.
Yeah. That's good thing that's
honestly,
in the past.
When watching it myself, the moment where I thought, like, okay, this definitely hooked Heil was the very beginning of K-Rool's number, where Clubba is quick to point out, no, you're the one who caused all of this. It's your obsession with the fact that these guys beat you once.
Your studies this lore like a fucking Bible.
I've always said, like, two of the things that could have really benefited the cartoon in my younger eyes were the additions of Clubba and Swanky Kong. So there you go.
I mean, they sacrificed Swanky for Bluster, so it's kind of a win-win when you think about it.
I mean, I don't know. Bluster's just missing. Hey, like,
yeah, no. No, I still am a staunch defender of a Bluster Kong, and I think he should be in everything.
I completely agree.
Yes, put him everywhere. Just put him everywhere. He doesn't belong there, but he needs to be there.
No. I'm going to turn this up a notch. Let's bring back Leo Luster.
He's too powerful. We already have Funky. So we do have a listener question here. Aiden64NES+ from social media asked, what was all of your first memories of K-Rool?
Oh, that was a good one. All right, so my first memory of K-Rool was actually, so let me preface this by saying, when I was growing up, I never owned an SNES. Like, I had a Sega Genesis, I was a Sega Genesis kid through and through, still kind of am, but I do have a soft spot for Donkey Kong Country and Super Nintendo as a whole, as I've aged. So I never had an SNES growing up, but my cousins did, and I was probably 6 or 7, and I would go over to my cousin's house on the weekdays after school because my parents wouldn't be home and they weren't just going to leave me at home. That's child abandonment. I would go over there and they happened to have an SNES along with a copy of Donkey Kong Country 1, 2, and 3. And we would play those games like literally every day. It would be that. Toon Disney, and then a few other things that we would do over there. But we had like this religion, basically, where we would do this every day. And a couple of times our saves got deleted, and everybody pointed fingers. Nobody knew who did it. But eventually we ended up making it to the end of the game. And that right there, between me and my cousin going back and forth, passing the controller off to each other, dying over and over and over and over, and having to refight Master Neki Senior, that was kind of my first introduction to K-Rool. And whenever I beat him finally, because I was the one who was able to beat him finally, it was the most satisfying, like, video game final boss that I had experienced up to that point.
And then because the only one that I had halfway through, and then K-Rool got
me. Yes, yes, he got me on the first time. Because I was like, "Oh, credits are rolling, game's over." No, it's not.
Oh, he was doing the MCU of post-credit stuff before anyone.
From there, it's just been kind of a gradual thing. I've with each iteration of K-Rool, I've just kind of grown to appreciate the character more, and he's become more nuanced as he's aged. So. Yeah, that's mine.
Mine kind of follows a similar pattern. Like, I kind of grew up with, N64 and whatnot. It's like, at the time, like, I was interested in trying out Donkey Kong 64. But this was back when it was, like, going out to Blockbuster, renting the game, putting it at home, and then telling me I can't play because they don't have that expansion pack. So I had to return it to Blockbuster, and I was like, there's such a cool gator in the front, though. Dang it. And at least this was game-wise, I remember. But I remember my cousin all had a Game Boy Color, and he like we would always like I would always like to play that thing, especially like Mario Land 2, 6 golden coins, where I would purposely go into the menu and just start erasing all their files because they wanted to play as Bomb Mario and I didn't know how, like turn into a bomb whenever you like erase the save files, and like they always got so fucking pissed when I did that. But I ended up playing like Donkey Kong Country on the Game Boy Color. They had a port of that, which, you know, it's like kind of interesting. Like it was definitely like a little bit more low grade, but that was kind of how I was introduced to playing like actual Donkey Kong Country games. And I played through it. And I remember when I got to K. Rool, I'm like, yo, this is so cool. And then ironically, I ended up playing Donkey Kong Land 2, which, you know, is Donkey Kong Country 2, but it's like on Game Boy. And I thought this was a prequel at first. I thought it was like Captain K. Rool was the first bad guy, and then the king came second. It's just like, I had no idea like what the timelines were at the time. So I didn't think too much about it, but like eventually, like when the cartoon started like airing over here in Canada, I was just like, oh man, it's like, I really liked, I never put two and two together. I did not know that King K. Rool, Captain K. Rool, and all that other stuff on like the TV were like the same person. I just thought they were like different guys just wearing the same hat or like two. And it was just like, so, it was so cool just playing through all this. And eventually I got closer with the Donkey Kong Country games and I played them like on the original Super Nintendo and playing them at Stuart's place when we ended up meeting out. He's all the way in Missouri. I had to like fly to him and we were like online friends for the longest time. This isn't exactly an old memory, like my first memory, but I still think it's funny to bring up nonetheless. I remember I was very avid on bringing in like more representation to Smash. This was like me young and hopeful being like, oh man, this was like, I think when, what was the one after Brawl? Smash 4 for like Wii U and 3DS. Mm-hmm. I was like so hopeful and being like,
yeah,
I was big. I found Super Smash Bros. 1 for N64 in a park when I moved in. So it's like, I already was introduced to like Smash, like the year kind of came out in like the weirdest way. Me and my cousin got into Melee and like my brother, and it was like we were very competitive with it. I didn't end up getting a Wii, but I remember us being disappointed with, like, Smash Bros. Brawl when we went through it, and I had a 3DS at the time and was playing the new one. I'm like, okay, this one's a little bit better, and they're adding some more characters later on. So I was, like, putting, like, an entire list of characters I wanted in, and I was like, oh, man, it would be so cool if they got, like, you know, they got Solid Snake in there. It'd be cool if they got Raiden in from Metal Gear, or I want to get more F-Zero representation, Black Shadow. I remember with the biggest one I was thinking we were going to be so hopeful with was K. Rool. And I was, like, really being a fan, starting to be, like, a bigger fan of K. Rool, like, over the times. And I'm like, oh, man, it'd be so cool. He's number one on the poll. He's got to make it through. And then they announced the Mii costume.
Yeah.
And Matt isn't even the word I want to describe. The next day, I sold my 3DS. I was that petty and angry.
I tried to talk you down.
I think it's relatable. I think we are all sort of in that psychic nadir, like when it was like what Bayonetta and Cloud like capped it off, and we were like, "That's it. That's it. The dream is dead." It was a dark time.
Kind of look at the back of that. It's like, I honestly, it's just kind of find it hilarious how petty I was. I'm not even like upset about the situation. Just kind of look back at it and just makes a good story and like just showing how much I've grown. These days, I'm just kind of like, you know, whoever gets in, good on them. I still appreciate like what they kind of brought out. If they do it, fine, cool. If not, you know, I haven't played like outside of like my 3DS, my last Nintendo system was honestly a GameCube. And I think I just kind of stuck to playing, like, old games, like, whenever I want, and just kind of appreciating things, because gaming these days is definitely a lot more different, a lot more microtransaction-y, and you kind of feel like there's, like, a lot of void space and weird production times, and Nintendo's very different from who they were back then, so, I don't know, I just kind of appreciate what's out there, like, what was before, and, you know, whatever new comes out and people appreciate, I'm like, good for you, I'm just gonna enjoy my old games. Not that I'm, like, a cranky old man, but I kind of feel like, you know, that's kind of where my heart is at, just like the old retro stuff.
I did it all with two buttons.
Oh, man, you damn, it's like, now I'm going to start sounding like cranky.
None of this fancy analog crap.
Yeah, you guys have all these, like, big stories with the character. Like, now for me, it was just, I just remember, like, in terms of getting introduced to him, it was just from, like, the original trilogy on the SNES. Like, those were probably some of my favorite games growing up, and to this day, they still are some of my favorite games. I replay them regularly, like on my Switch. But yeah, he was just a villain I always really liked. I always found him like funny in the cartoon, and he was a fun challenge in the games. And yeah, he's just been a villain that I've always really enjoyed. Not really much of a story to that, but yeah, that's what it is.
Well, how did it feel then on August 8th, 2018, when K. Rool was revealed for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate? Because the whole like impetus behind this short, like the capper is, you know, K. Rool's been gone a decade, mirroring the absence in the games where he didn't appear between Mario Super Sluggers and Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. And of course, then it ends with him getting the invite. So where were you that day? What, like, how did it feel to know that K. Rool was actually making it into Smash Brothers at long last?
It was wild. Like, I'm going to tell you straight up. It was weird. I was in a state of disbelief.
Mm. Yeah, I thought then, it was fake at first.
I did too. And then it was like, I went through the stages of reverse grief, I guess. where like there was like yes, and then also oh crap, I don't own any modern Nintendo consoles. I'll probably never be able to own any because I don't have a stable job at the time and didn't have a whole lot of money, so I kind of settled on the fact that I was probably never going to be able to play him, play as him, unless I went over to somebody's house who happened to have it. And lo and behold, I ended up getting a Switch, and so yeah.
I remember really wanting to beat the fucking shit out of King DDD after this. I was just like, I was like kind of seeing it happen. I was just like, okay, they're probably going to, like, clearly they're hyping up something. It's like, and I was like, oh man, that's shaped like K. Rool. Why are they in DK's place? And it's, you know, King DDD, like, I mean, like, by now I should have realized, you know, they wouldn't be hyping something like this so ridiculously. But at the end, I was like, I was a younger, more immature mind back then. I was just like, fuck it. just like ready to just like be upset about all this. And then he comes in, gives him like the slap of the century. And I'm like, oh, cool.
All has been forgiven.
Yeah, I was just like, I don't even remember like being like super excited or anything. I just kind of saw this. Just like, I think I was just like, I had so much emotions just kind of going through when I actually saw like K. Rool actually pop up. It's like, oh, is this? It's like I found like the it was like the equivalent of like young me finding like the life equation or something and being like, I understand now. Like the little zoom in of like Frank Reynolds, Danny DeVito is like,
the universe is 42. I understand.
Honestly, I it was such a crazy time, really. I didn't even have Smash Bros anymore at this point. I'm happy that he's back in there. I mean outside of just like going over to a friend's place or playing with Stuart, like I just kind of, you know, played in a little bit. It was like, oh, this is really dang cool. But younger me, I definitely would have been like a lot more hyped and ready to like play in all this stuff. But honestly, I'm just like happy he finally got his recognition, because I know Smash Bros. Is more than just a fighting game. It's just like it's an entire legacy of like all these video game characters coming together and appreciating, like, you know, the culture that these characters have impacted. Some of them, I still question why they're there, but that's not my place to say. I got a bunch of my characters in there, and I'm just happy about it. I'm glad there was representation from like F-Zero with Captain Falcon. I'm glad my Daisy Basie is in it instead of just like a separate Peach skin. K. Rool's in it, fantastic. Stuart was super happy about Ridley being in there.
Yes,
honestly, it was just like it was just like them recognizing so many characters, and it's like I got some that are in there. I didn't get some. It's what it is. I could just like sit back and enjoy it, but I don't know. For me, I'm just still playing the old Smash Bros. Games, but I wouldn't be opposed to, you know, playing a bit of Ultimate at a friend's house or something. Just very different play style.
Return to Crocodile Isle is impressively densely packed with little Easter eggs and rewards for paying attention for folks who intimately know the games and the cartoon. Were there any references or homages that you wanted to get in but couldn't quite make it work?
Oh. I'm sure Martin has the list.
Oh, man. Like we mentioned, a lot of it was just limited to, like, stuff with, you know, the union and the voice actors we wanted to work with and all that crazy stuff. But we had so many crazy ideas. Some, like, were just, like, little mentions on, like, you know, the cutting room floor. I know we wanted to, like, have some art pieces of, I mean, obviously, it's like we knew that Alex could only, like, work with so many models, and we had so many ideas of characters we wanted to bring in there, and we were also thinking maybe we could do, like, simple art pieces of them just to kind of show them. The same way we, like, you know, acknowledge, like, Cruncha or, you know, the non-Kremlin bad guys with the little baby K. Rool Steve Irwin painting that was done. amazing job by Brandon.
I love that.
And we were thinking, like, what other characters we could kind of bring in there. And I know, like, at some point we were thinking, yo, we should just, like, because we were thinking, how obscure could we go into this? We were originally, my ideas was, like, we should have maybe, like, a kind of monthly magazine that almost looks like Playboy, where it's just, like, Pots and Pans Monthly or something with, like, you know, K. Rool's wife on the cover or something. But we kind of realized, you know, it's like, you know, it's like we don't really see K. Rool as a deviant. And it's like, you know, it's like it was just like little mentions of that of the cutting room floor. I know one of our other last minute ideas, we wanted to give a little bit more to the Northern Kremisphere. Those guys, I know we had like a certain adaptation for them. We always thought the Northern Kremisphere would be like the Canada of the fucking Kremlin territories. So we always joked about it. It's like we should just have them talking like weird ass accents. And what was that Saturday Night Live skit? It's like Bill Swirsky super fans, the ones where they're just like, it's like a Chris Farley and Mike Myers are all sitting around together just like talking about like the Bears football team and just like eating like a ridiculous amount of food. It's just like we got the predictions coming and we already know who's gonna win. The Bears. We always imagine that like it would be like that. So we kind of thought it'd be cool to like kind of have like a little postcard on the side and be like, wish you were here, and they're just like sitting in a similar kind of table. We were gonna have like some other ideas, like I know we wanted to get like a mention of like Lord Frederick in there and probably have a restraining order against K. Rool or something.
Yeah.
On his obsession. Just little things here and there. But I think one of my favorites that actually got pretty far in through the cutting room, like it almost might made it out of the cutting room floor, but we just kind of realized based on time it wasn't exactly going to work out. But it was one of my favorite jokes too. So there was going to be a lot more discussion about the Rareware characters actually. We were going to, like, outside of the little Carnath rules, like, graffiti that's, like, at the bottom of, like, one of the tables, we were going to actually acknowledge, and that's where Crusher was going to kind of go into this, where his whole thing that Al did a great job, like, writing this part, too, and it was just, like, you know, that little bit where he's just, like, you know, the higher power, him and by proxy us, were unfit. That whole spiel was going to be, like, a fun little thing where it's just, like, Crusher's the only one that remembers any of this happening, as well as the other Rareware characters. What would have ended up transpiring, and you could hear bits and pieces of the dialogue when, you know, K. Rool's going through, like, his little glitchy phase. You could hear certain words of it, but it went something along the lines of banter between Clump and Crusher talking, and it's just, like, Crusher's like, what, you don't remember the bear? What bear? The one with the backpack. What kind of monster puts a bird in a backpack? The same one that fought the witch. And there was an inebriated squirrel. Witches, drunk squirrels, what's next? Chameleon bat hybrids battling horny toads? And then Crusher, you know, being Crusher, is just like, he thinks that he convinced Clump. He's like, yeah, and there was also an operatic pile of and then the bard would come back. Because the bard had a second part of his song, and it
literally starts with,
yeah, Clef, amazingly sung by Tom. I fucking love it. he comes back and does his, you know, his little People Are Strange, The Doors, like, kind of tune that ironically was based off of, I think David Wise based People Are Strange by The Doors for the Donkey Kong Country 2 main theme, which is where we got it from. So he kind of comes back with that same thing. And as Crusher says, inebriating pile of he kind of comes in breaking into
song. It's been many a moon
and too many a sundown since our former king went and ran us aground, leaving us stranded with no one to please. We sit on our asses while drinking and then he gets shot, and that's when K. Rool comes in. So we had a whole thing kind of planned for this, and like the voice acting and the writing was hilarious. Like Adrian had a great, like, did like a lot of great improvisational bits as Clump with that whole thing. But yeah, it's like, it was one of my favorite jokes I would have loved to have gone in. It's just like, work more towards the adult PG humor that we go for. But yeah, that was like probably one of my favorite ones that I wish I could have done. But I think at the end, it was just one of those things that would have kind of disrupted the flow of, you know, Hyrule's psychotic like descent and the kind of like surreal imagery we wanted. So, you know,
I storyboarded and timed it out, and like, as fun as those scenes were, I just kind of felt like that scene was going on a little too long. Like, and we got group feedback too, feeling the same way. So like, unfortunately not everything can kind of fit in when you're trying to communicate a story.
And honestly, it's like, it also means like, just because you can write the best jokes doesn't always mean it's just the best thing to put in the script. Like, we wrote some hilarious things, but you know, we knew like it wasn't gonna like fit with like the gist of the story. So it honestly, it was for the best, but still makes for a fun deleted scene idea,
right?
No, it's wild to hear that there was references to, you know, the greater Donkey Kong universe beyond just Donkey Kong. That really pleases me, of course. But speaking of only partially heard dialogue in this, we did have a question about this on social media. Smashers, at PK Smash Brothers on Twitter, wanted to know, and I quote, honestly, what was DK's dialogue regarding Winky, if there was any, since it gets blocked out by the Kremlins at the end?
Oh. Yeah, this one, I mean, apart, we were thinking of like kind of having it like obscured in the background and keep people guessing a little bit, but I mean, because the focus is on K. Rool, really. Like, it's about what he's kind of really going through. So we just kind of added that in there as, like, a random little bit of Walla. But honestly, like, that bit of the flashback is, because we were originally thinking, like, all the different ways DK could, like, completely not know that that Swanky is talking about K. Rool. You know, Portly Claude, Kraid. And then he's like, okay, perhaps that green friend of yours, the one you haven't seen in quite some time. And when was the last time we saw Winky? He was taxidermied in, like, Cranky's cabin, like, in Donkey Kong Country 2, I think, was it?
Yeah, and prior to that, it was in Gorilla Glacier in game.
So this was DK having a little bit of an emotional moment, being reminded, thinking he was talking about Winky. Because he said, you know, green friend, and he's like, Winky? See, that's kind of a touchy subject. Cranky had his remains taxidermy. And obviously, it gets cut off like, you know, at a certain point over there. That's where we kind of left it off. And a lot of people were digging in really deep into this. It's like, oh, maybe this is the moment he's actually talking about K. Rool. Or it's like, oh, he's actually talking about Cranky, because he mentions Cranky and he did have that green vest. And this is probably, you know, an homage to Aaron Tager, who passed away, which, you know, God bless his soul, but people really dug really deep into this. And
I don't know if you all realize how deep people have been digging into this. There is currently ongoing, as we speak, campaign for Sea of Thieves. They've got this mystery going on where you can win prizes, and people are like, there's all these really like baroque clues, and people are just like pulling up coordinates on maps and doing all sorts, like Rare sending people on a wild goose chase basically, and people still can't figure out how to solve it. But your video actually got pulled into the discussion in the Sea of Thieves community. And for like a day, people were convinced that you had actually produced this with Rare as some sort of like clue in the Sea of Thieves mystery. So that is how much it's reaching people. It's like full on like Paul is dead status, right? Like it's crazy. But yeah, I think it was like within our friend circle had to break it to people. It's like, No, this has nothing to do. We know who made this. This has nothing to do with Rare. This is not part of the Sea of Thieves mystery. You're wasting your time, but please watch it anyway. But yes, it was a trip hearing Richard Yearwood's Donkey Kong name drop like Bowser, Kraid, and Winky. Like the Animal Buddies never came up on the cartoon. So to hear him say Winky in that distinctive voice was just like, worlds colliding, your brain can't handle it. You're just like, the dissonance is just like deafening. But since you did have him And the rest of the voice cast, did you ever feel like abusing that power just a little bit? And getting them to name drop all sorts of ridiculous things that would have never been brought up in the cartoon?
Not a name drop per se, but there is something perfect. There is a moment we had with Richard Yearwood, and I think it's a great story.
I'll leave it to you.
All right. So, you know, with Richard Yearwood and Ben specifically, we recorded at the Cherry Beach Sound, which was, recording studio pretty well known in Toronto near, like, the Union Station area. This is, like, a record studio best known for, like, they did records with, like, Justin Bieber, 50 Cent, Rush, just, like, it's really well known in, like, the music community. So we were working with some pretty prestigious sound stuff over there. For the case of Ben, it wasn't so much of a name drop thing, but it was actually an outtake that we did catch. And it was one of the most hilarious things because we were having like quite a bit of time just going through like the rap segment. And we cut it to like, you know, chunks because, you know, anyone that could like rap that long is like, you know, I think even Eminem would be staying quiet for the rest of his life. But no, it's just like Ben, like honestly, like just want to clarify, working with Ben, like, was like one of the best recording experiences I've ever had in my life. The man was an absolute professional and phenomenal. It's just like the man comes from Stratford, which is like a lot of like theater production, so he's like has like thespian knowledge in Shakespeare for like decades on decades, and he was gonna drive an hour and a half one way to do some crocodile sounds for us and then drive back. And it's just like me and Stuart have like no idea what we're doing. Like it's like in regards to voice direction, it's like for the first little bit it was like really It was just like a really weird phase where we were just trying to read like the temperature of the room, how we were going to interact, because you know, he was like super professional and everything. And afterwards, it's just like we just really got the ball rolling, and he was like enjoying the song and recording through it, and we were just like having like fun little anecdotes here and there, and just like enjoying the company. I ended up buying a lunch for everyone over there. On top, and then when we got back into like recording for this, we were getting through like the rap segment again, so we got it into chunks, and obviously we're recording bits and pieces here and there, so we were doing like different different takes. And I remember one of the best funniest parts was Ben going through the third or fourth time with the introduction in character, flubbing his lines and then swearing as K. Rule. It was one of the best moments I've ever heard. I'm just like, please tell me you got that record.
I still want to animate some of that swearing dialogue.
Oh my god, yes, I think it'll be perfect. And but yeah, that's like one of the things that happened. The other thing was with Richard specifically. He happened to have been in Canada at the time. And he would be, and we had the option of whether we wanted him, because it was just like DK on the TV, right? And we were just thinking, you know, we probably don't need the best quality. We could just have him do it over the phone. And I'm just like, you know what? I want to make sure we get like the best quality we could out of this. We don't know how it's going to work out, just in case. You know, also, it's just be nice to meet the guy in person and see what it's like working with him. So he had a very short bit of the script. We only showed in the post-credit scene because we obviously wanted to, like, surprise the context and everything that was going on. We just told him we just needed him to reprise Donkey Kong again for, like, a little scene. And he got through the lines, and it was great. He had, like, some, you know, he did, like, a good amount of takes. He was, like, a super, you know, fun, chillax guy. It was just kind of still crazy to think he was in front of us. I remember Al was in the call with us. Because we had like a Zoom call going on at the same time. I even got like Al to like chat with him a few times and show him like his Donkey Kong impression from the Abridged series, which was you know, I'm pretty sure it was like a big highlight in like Al's life when he was just like, oh man, that's like perfect, why didn't you hire him?
I wish we had the audio of that because it was pretty great.
It was but the part was like at the very end, he goes through the lines and he just wanted to check if there's anything else he wanted to record. And then a light bulb went into my head over something I wanted to do. And Alex and Stuart, unfortunately, knew exactly what I was going to ask. So I said, and I was the kind of person that's just like, you know what? I'm the kind of person that's just going to ask because that's the only way we know for sure. We miss 100% of our shots, right? So I was just like, Richard, there is one thing I do want to ask if you could do for us. And Alex is looking at me. And I'm just like, there is
Because I'm the one who brought it up in the first place.
I think I know where this is going.
There's a specific meme on the internet regarding Donkey Kong, and I just wondered if you could just say it for us. Could you please utter the words, "You may spank it once"? And like half a second later, Alex comes in and he's like, "I assure you, it is not as dirty as it sounds." And then Richard's face was like going through like probably the five stages of something, wondering what he got himself into. And I just remember he was just kind of was laughing to himself. And then he did two takes of the line. And then he said, "My agent doesn't know about this." But honestly, it was just like such a great, chillax guy to work with. You know, shook hands with us. We took off our, like, for both him and Ben, because we were still working with like quarantine and masks. You know, they wanted to see how our faces look, just so like, you know, they could, you know, properly, you know, see us and, you know, have this be like a good in-person thing. These were great guys to work with all around. And, you know, it was like we had our funnies, but honestly, it was just like such a great professional work environment, and just getting to work with like these kind of voices that I grew up with is just such a surreal experience. Like, Jesus Christ. But yeah, it's like those are just two notable funnies that we might have like recorded. Not exactly abusing power. Okay, maybe. But honestly, just kind of one of those things worth mentioning over like what the recording process was kind of like. We got through our lines. There was like such a, you know, great amount of like communication, integrity, and just exploring the characters here and there. And yeah, I guess honestly, that was like the most really got out of a crazy little thing going on there.
I mean, I can relate. When we had Grant Kirkhope, I may have gotten him to record a few things as Donkey Kong for my own private benefit. But maybe I'll see the light of day sometime.
I mean, for the dialogue we got, like, our goal is to animate it one day once I get some free time. Maybe upload it to kind of as a little extra promo thing.
So I'm sure you've all heard the rumors that Nintendo and Illumination's plan was to potentially use the Super Mario Brothers movie as a springboard for a Donkey Kong movie. Bayon the Bear on Twitter wanted to know, I wanted to ask, if y'all were put 100% in charge of the DK movie, what would you want to do? Would it resemble Return to Crocodile Isle in any way? Would you bring back the classic VAs like Campbell again?
Now we're talking, so, like, Nintendo gives us full control and budget, right?
Because because the budget is the important part.
That's one. The other thing is, I know Nintendo has a specific vision, keeping things as, like, low bar, like, maybe not the best words, but they want to have something that's applicable to, like, all ages and all demographics. Easy to get, like, the seats warm over there, right? Uh-huh. We're talking, you know, like, celebrity star-studded casting. It's like the way Hollywood is. I understand it. And it's a little bit hard when it's just like you have such a, like, for me, K. Rool has always been like such a interesting, rich character that has like his own like mental, you know, issues that I think he kind of has much more layers than your common Disney villain, where it's just like, sorry, common Nintendo video game villain, where it's just like, kidnap the princess. All right, I'll get you next time. With K. Rool, it honestly feels like there's always been such a series of events that you can understand his development. Like, you know, I know Stewart had like this whole lore for like, you know, how K. Rool like kind of got around to like what he is with our universe. But I guess for simplicity of the game, it's game one, Donkey Kong Country. He wants to take over the island, steal the bananas, all that stuff. He's stopped by Donkey Kong and Diddy. So he obviously sees like DK as like his rival. So he's just like, okay, I'm going to get rid of DK. And now there's no way they could stop me. They're in my own home turf. There's no way they could defeat me. And somehow his sidekick and his girlfriend beat him. Game number three. Okay, I'll take the sidekick and Donkey Kong. Literally the Batman and Robin duo over here. And it's like, there's absolutely no way they can take me. I'm in another country right now. Disguise. I have robots working for me. And then it's like the girlfriend and the baby beat him. And then Donkey Kong 64 happens. He's probably going through like an immense like fucking overload of like things. He stopped with the disguises. I like to think that his disguises on top of maybe K-Roll having some background of wanting to be an actor before being involved in politics, I think he's just uses that as a way of, like, you know, trying to ignore his past mistakes and failures and not admitting to them. I think there's, like, some real underlying, like, fuckery with, like, the kind of things that he sees himself in, like, the disguises, and, like, I think he also has, like, severe, like, bipolar from the looks of it, too. Like, and it's just, like, he gets into, like, such crazy, like, mood swing. He's, like, in this, like, Darth Vader mood, and he's just like, okay, the entire island is going to get ransacked. It's going to be, like, fucking destroyed by this, like, Dr. Evil, like, styled laser over here. I kidnapped every single one of the Kongs I could get my hands on. Donkey Kong is the only one left that I couldn't get. There is absolutely no way they can get me. I have a doomsday device on me that will, like, destroy them once and for all. So I think this is, like, K-Rool at his, like, most unhinged phase. Who beats him? Like, DK rescues all of them, and it's not even DK that beats him. It's, like, you know, Chunky Kong. And I think, like, after that, I just kind of can't help but think, you know, looking past, like, all the crazy little, you know, adventures he's kind of had in the side games, like, K-Rool is probably, like, at his limit over here. He's dealt with, like, probably, like, the worst case of depression in his life. He just realized his entire thing has been, like, going through and through. And I think just from, like, also from, like, my, like, you know, just going from, like, a time as, like, an artist, actor kind of thing, just dealing with failures and ups, like, you know, like, feeling like you can't do anything.
Burnout.
Right? Like, there's a burnout. There's creative juices that are just, like, gone. You feel like you can't do anything right. He literally risked the economy of his own damn army for his, like, ego and all that crazy stuff. And I can't help but think that would make such a great villain for, you know, a Donkey Kong movie, especially. Not just from, like, the case of, oh, K-Rool's, like, you know, has a whole, you know, has, like, a whole history of it. He needs to be the next villain. I also just think from, like, a film standpoint, he could be one of those villains that would have so many good layers to him and would be so fantastic. It's just, like, when we got to, like, Return to Crocodile Isle, it's, obviously, you could see, like, there's, like, so many, like, you know, like, so many surreal implications of, like, his demented, like, nature and, like, his, you know, like, all the other kind of stuff that's, like, playing into his mind. I think it would just, like, make for, like, a lot of great villain, like, villain material for this film. And I would really love if the film would dig deep into that. And Jack Black was fantastic as Bowser, just, like, fun. I can't imagine anyone else for the role. But I know the way they wrote Bowser would not be, like, the way they wrote Bowser, I don't think they would be able to be as supportive as the way we would want to write, like, a complexity with, like, K-Rool as we would want to do. And I kind of feel like this day and age, there are a lot of great children's cartoons that have very, you know, layered, complex villains, like Mr. Freeze from Batman the Animated Series, Nox from Wok Fu Season 1, which is, ironically, another animated show based off of a video game that is really fantastic.
Yeah. That was actually one of our big inspirations for, like, the animation style that we were wanting.
Yeah, yeah, Wok Fu was, like, huge into that. It's just, like, I kind of feel like if we were to go through with this, or at least me, I would love to have it where it's just, like, almost, like, I want to have it almost feel like more of a villain piece and, like, Donkey Kong kind of, like, second fiddle. Maybe it's, like, kind of like the way Tim Burton did Batman, where it's, like, it feels, like, more like the Joker's kind of, like, the main focus on it. I would love to do it like that, and we kind of see him, how he's brought through with his armies, and what kind of implementation he would kind of have, the kind of, like, you know, descent into madness to his, like, eventual defeat of DK. I'd really love for this to be, like, a really unique off-the-walls, like, villain piece, which I think was something we tried to, like, echo over here with our short film, but I don't know. I feel like it's just one of those things that I think Nintendo would just kind of look at us as, like, this is a little bit, we just want to sell toys.
Right. What I did appreciate, as somebody who has thought way too long about K-Rool's mental state, the way you portrayed his sort of like flashbacks to his failures, and just the way it was like television interference, like static, like cutting into his own brain, and then the way that was mirrored at the end with Donkey Kong on the TV, I thought that was brilliant. It just communicated so much without actually spelling out, hey, he's going through some things.
Yeah, I don't want the audience to just be dumbed down. I kind of want this stuff to be open for interpretation. Just let people watch it and be like, oh man, what parts were, you know, here, not there? And it's like, it's one of those things that I really appreciate in film. It's just when you kind of have things that are a little bit more open-ended and people feel like they're able to, like, answer the questions on their own, I think that just delves into, like, much more discussion. I think, I mean, obviously it would be, like, such a downer note if we just ended it right as, like, right before the credits rolled. But we also wanted to just, like, kind of give him, like, a little bit of a, you know, like, you know, a treat for having to deal with all this shit that he's been going through. That's where the Smash invite kind of came in. And originally it was supposed to be, like, a lot shorter, and then we had it, like, way too long. And then we just kind of ended up getting this, like, you know, just right amount with Alex's, like, super, like, you know, guidance on this. And we always knew, like, we wanted to have, like, the excuse be something so stupid and ridiculous. Like, Klumpf honestly thinking that he didn't even know his own boss's name. So it's just like he keeps forwarding it back thinking they got the wrong address or whatever. And we're thinking this whole time why Carol's, like, you know, in depression, plotting, hiding away, dealing with his own, like, little musical numbers in his head. He had every chance to be in Smash Bros. and we thought this was the most canonical explanation we could get, where it's just like, okay, this is why he wasn't in Smash Bros. For this long. And we kind of thought it was, like, a little bit funny, and, you know, a lot of us were demanding for a good little while. We wanted something that was, like, in character, but, you know, also something that people would feel like it's almost official enough to be. It's like, I want people to feel like this is, like, their canon. This is how dedicated we were to making sure we did this just right.
Yeah, well, our own Dustin Jackson, DK Vine staffer, who's a huge fan of the cartoon, he had a great line when he first watched this the day it premiered. And I quote, "Amazing that someone can just do this." And it reminds me of, like, personally, it reminds me of, I don't know if any of you watch the show 30 Rock. But
yes, I do.
Yeah, yeah, so there's an episode of 30 Rock where Kenneth the Page is a big fan of the show Night Court, like the original Night Court. Like, this is long before they actually brought Night Court back. But he wanted to use his resources as an employee of NBC to force the cast back together to film a proper finale to Night Court. And it's, you know, it's completely farcical. It's just a mess. But it's legitimately inspiring to see that, you know, even though this is ostensibly an unofficial fan-produced project, you have actually done that. You've contributed to the legacy of a beloved cartoon that's now spawned generations of admirers and memes. Don't forget the memes.
The memes are always good.
So, I mean, if I argued for such things, I would argue that if you are a fan of the Donkey Kong Country cartoon, this should be viewed as canon. And, you know, I thank you for bridging that massive chasm between Donkey Kong fans who adore the cartoon and, well, I guess just me. But I feel seen, especially considering for all of my childhood aversions to the cartoon, it was actually never towards the voice cast. I actually liked the voice cast. You know, like,
oh, we always said the same thing. Like, say what you want about the show, the voice acting's great.
Like, yeah, like, yeah, nothing against Seth Rogen or Fred Armisen, but if I'm gonna picture the characters in my head or hear them in my head, I'm probably gonna hear the ones from the cartoon first and foremost. So, you know, now when people ask me, is there one episode of the cartoon that you like? I can say, yeah, you know what? There is. Return the Crocodile Isle. So,
got him.
Thank the three of you and everyone involved with it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank
it's,
you.
It's been a huge labor of love, like, crazy little production. We live, like, 2.5 years. And honestly, just being able to work with a phenomenal team and just, like, getting this inspiration, it just kind of makes something and showing people could just do things on their own, too. I mean, obviously, this was no easy task, and this was a time where we kind of were handed a unique opportunity with the pandemic and just getting to know each other a little bit more. But it's just really inspiring just being able to, like, work with, you know, all these amazing people, the artists and, you know, the voice actors, our designers, everything, like, from even, like, the promo stuff to Alex and Stuart, just, like, everyone just, like, did such a phenomenal thing. So I can't even just call myself, like, you know, just the only, like, the, like, a director. I feel like I was directed by everyone else and, like, what they felt was right for it. And it's just an amazing community, like both working wise and just like the Donkey Kong community for like accepting this with such open arms. I just want to say thank you guys for just giving us the shot, having faith in us, and just appreciating what we kind of did together here, because I think this is just more than just like a simple fan film, like everyone says. It's honestly just like a great thing to just bring the community together, appreciate like the good memories of you know, the games, the show, everything that it meant through, and just being able to just bring some veteran voice actors back for one last little hurrah. I mean, who's to say if, like, you know, Ben or Adrian or Ron kind of, or Richard kind of come back to doing their roles again. I'm not sure myself, but honestly, I was just glad I was able to at least give this one last little swan song to show what Donkey Kong, K. Rool, and the world means to me, and being able to accept it as like such high regard, it's my biggest honor. I'm sorry, I said a mouthful. Everyone was just like, cool, thanks.
No, you're good.
I guess a more succinct way of putting it was, you may thank it once.
This has been a File 2 production.
Kerikoo.